You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
It's the first time that Apple have actually decided to tell people about something that they're developing.
High-speed broadband. Let's just make sure that we can get it in Australia this year, not next.
The three main spamming countries are the United States, China, and South Korea.
And I've got some residual powers.
Sounds like something out of Harry Potter.
Senator Coonan, the voice of reason.
There's a couple of systems on a gantry that's actually based on a military missile tracking system.
You put the date on ePray, and you get a whole service just on it.
How does it go?
IE7, you were having trouble installing it because you had a genuine copy of Windows that wouldn't validate properly. What did you have to do to get past that?
Built a new machine.
But how hard can it be?
Well, it's not hard at all.
At the end of the day, the photography is all about the person's eye and what they see.
If you find something that's inappropriate about your child, you need to do something about it because it will not go away.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Tech Talk Radio. I'm your host, Andrew McComb. In the not-too-distant future, web surfers globally will have new versions of their favourite web browser foisted upon them from all the major players. Apple Safari, Microsoft's Internet Explorer and Mozilla Firefox are battling to become your browser of choice. So which one will you use? Safari 3.1, Firefox 3 or Internet Explorer 8? Apple's latest offering, Safari 3.1, preserves the company's signature focus on clean design and smooth usability, but it does lack any phishing or malware filters. For its part, Mozilla should have applied the finishing touches to Firefox 3 by now. From under-the-hood memory improvements to a major reworking for bookmarks, version 3 represents a big step forward for Mozilla. Whereas the new Firefox and Safari browsers are ready to roll, Microsoft's early beta of Internet Explorer 8 remains a work in progress. Bugs and rough edges are to be expected in the first beta, intended for developers and testers. But IE 8 Beta 1 provides a glimpse of the new features such as web slices, which let sites create widgety snippets of information that you can view by clicking a bookmark button, and activities, which adds right-click menu options for looking up selected text and pages on map, translation, and other sites that will distinguish the browser Microsoft eventually releases. From an end user's point of view, upgrading web browsers should be, as the great author Douglas Adams said as he described the inhabitants of planet Earth, mostly harmless. But spare a thought for web developers. With hundreds of changes to stylesheet implementations, what are the chances websites built for current browsers will look the same in the new browsers? Professionally speaking, Safari and Firefox are the most reliable browsers when it comes to displaying websites on your screen. Microsoft's Internet Explorer is riddled with bugs and strange, unexplainable anomalies which most of us turn a blind eye to. Let's hope Microsoft's IE 8 conforms to internet standards a little better than its previous incarnations.
This week on Tech Talk Radio,
Adam Turner talks to Communications Minister Stephen Conroy about the future of digital TV in this country. The Indiana Jones of data recovery, Graham Henley, director and co-developer of the world's leading data recovery software applications, GetData, joins us live in the studio to talk about the pitfalls of recovering lost data. We take a look at the world's most powerful brands for 2008, technologically. TiVo's introduction in Australia is not sailing as smooth as first thought. Optus takes a leaf from Telstra's book and sinks the boots into Canberra. And eBay sellers may be restricted to cheaper items. First up, though, here's the latest happenings from the Tech Talk News Desk with Graham Callaghan.
This is Tech Talk News.
This week on Tech Talk News, a software update causes a Foxtel blackout, Google makes improvements to image search, Internode says broadband to Tasmania is just too expensive, the ACMA says there's now a phone for every man, woman and child in Australia, and researchers at Hewlett-Packard discover the missing link in electrical circuits. Welcome to Tech Talk News. Foxtel customers were without television for 30 minutes last Thursday when a software update was sent to subscribers' set-top boxes. Foxtel said the interruption only lasted 5 to 8 minutes, but many customers complained of outages of up to half an hour, from 9:12 p.m. to about 9:45 p.m. Live programming was affected and subscribers with scheduled recordings lost them completely. A Foxtel spokesman said that due to a system issue on Thursday night, subscribers' services were temporarily affected by a software update and apologised for any inconvenience. Users were either greeted with a message throughout the outage saying the service was updating, or in some cases only a blank screen was displayed. The outage is an embarrassment for Foxtel, which is preparing to launch its high-definition channels and new IQ2 HD set-top box by the middle of this year. Google researchers presented a paper last week at the International World Wide Web Conference in Beijing, explaining a new algorithm which combines image recognition with traditional PageRank software. VisualRank is a new system which recognizes objects in images, allowing for better search results and reducing the need to rely on text-based cues associated with catalogued images. Google researchers said that image analysis remained a largely unsolved problem in computer science, and that while progress had been made in automatic face detection, the ability to find and index other objects in images had lagged. The research focused on a subset of images that Google has catalogued. Researchers said that VisualRank would not work for all images indexed by the search engine because of the massive number that were catalogued. Instead, researchers concentrated on the top 2,000 most popular product inquiries. As a result, Google believes that its image search using VisualRank will be the most comprehensive image search available on the World Wide Web. Aussie ISP Internode last week announced a reduction in ADSL 2+ services to Tasmania, citing Telstra's monopoly backhaul from the mainland as too expensive. On its website, Internode said that broadband backhaul capacity across Bass Strait is currently limited to a monopoly supplier, Telstra, and that as a result, it is 6 times more expensive for Internode to transfer data between Melbourne and Hobart than it is to move data between Melbourne and the United States. While Internode will continue to offer its high-end business ADSL 2+ plans, it will no longer offer home ADSL 2+ or 8 megabit per second plans to new customers from Tuesday this week. Analysts believe this situation could have been avoided if the Basslink optical fibre cable had been commissioned. While the cable began carrying electricity for the national power grid early in 2006, negotiations between government and commercial parties on activating the link's network portion have been entirely unproductive. Internode's managing director, Simon Hackett, also blamed the federal government's current national broadband network tender. Mr. Hackett said that Tasmania's backhaul issue offered an example of Telstra's behaviour when it was the sole owner of network infrastructure. Internode's announcement comes 1 month after Australian IT reported that the Tasmanian government had stumbled in its long-running effort to increase competition in the island's $450 million broadband market. Australian IT also reported that Melbourne ISP Netspace had been forced to shut down several broadband services in Tasmania because they were no longer economically viable on Telstra's network. The Australian Communications and Media Authority says there's now a mobile phone service for every man, woman and child in Australia, and less than one public phone for every 400 people. The figures were published in the ACMA's annual communications report released last week, showing that active mobile phone services had climbed to 21.26 million at the end of June, up 7.6% from June 2006. The ACMA believes that this is partly due to the take-up of 3G services. ACMA's chairman, Mr. Chris Chapman, said there were more than 4.5 million 3G mobile services in Australia, a 192% increase over the 12 months to last June. Mr. Chapman also said that as mobile phone ownership rates near saturation, mobile service providers are looking for growth in the 3G market, where customers are offered faster data rates and greater functionality. In contrast, the number of fixed phone services in Australia continued to decline, falling from 11.26 million in June 2006 to 10.92 million or 3% last June. The number of public phones fell 14% to just under 50,000 over the 12 months to last June. The report said Telstra had removed 1,062 public phones in urban areas, 581 in rural areas, and 21 in remote areas. While it might have taken 40 years to find, scientists at Hewlett-Packard say they have discovered a new type of electrical circuit which could lead to the production of faster booting computers. While basic electronics theory has always held there were three fundamental building blocks in a passive circuit, resistors, capacitors, and inductors, the existence of a fourth component called a memory resistor, or memristor for short, has been proven possible by HP researchers. An article in the journal Nature explained that the memristor is very different to other electrical devices in that it remembers both the direction and the amount of charge that flows through it. Conventional computers use dynamic random access memory, which is lost when the power is turned off, but a computer incorporating memristor memory could boot up to the exact state it was in when it was last shut down. Researchers also believe that memristor technology could keep the computer industry on track to satisfy Moore's law, the exponential growth in processing power every 18 months. Tech Talk Radio News was compiled by Dr. Ron, and I'm Graham Callaghan, and that's your tech update for this week.
Hi, I'm Rico Malver, Managing Director of Microsoft Research in Redmond in the U.S. Be sure to tune in to Tech Talk Radio soon when I'll be talking about the future of technology.
Previously on Tech Talk Radio.
Let's talk about the total population of broadband users at the moment.
Do we know how many people are actually using the internet? How many people have access to the internet?
Someone unsubscribed today.
Aww. Let's shame them. What's their email address?
Have you heard of the Fast Flux?
Excuse me?
At the time, no one had a computer that was fast enough to run it.
To run Windows 95.
Well, to run the Plus Pack. They put online.
Don't interrupt, Dr. Ron.
It's a love-hate relationship, isn't it?
It is. It is.
What's the one thing that we need for instant-on, always-there access to streaming video?
Fast broadband, please. Real broadband. Broad broadband.
Not skinny broadband like we've got now.
Telstra assures that 000 calls commencing before midnight will be allowed to continue until finished.
Oh, that's big of them.
I do believe they are misleading the customers.
Have a good long, hard look at yourself, fella.
A lot of gossip coming up here.
STFU, I am Lee Hexo.
Reverse the polarity of the neutron flow.
Nothing to do with that.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Tech Talk Radio, wherever you may be listening to us, around the country, around the world. I'm Andrew McComb, and sitting across in front of me today are three gentlemen with three laptops with three independent operating systems. I'm very impressed. Introducing the man in the corner with the Macintosh machine, JD. Lovely to see you again, JD.
Hi, everyone. Great to be back.
That's good. And you've got the lovely little the notebook there, the Mac notebook?
I do. It's an older one. It's a PowerBook G4.
Yeah.
Running OS 10.
Absolutely. We're all connected wirelessly to the internet. Come on, so do your worst, everybody. Send us emails. We're watching. In the middle is Dr. Ron. He has, I'm not sure what it is. What operating system are you operating this evening?
Dr. Ron here with the man in the middle running Ubuntu 8.04, Hardy Heron, and it's going extremely well.
Ah, fantastic. And you've also got your operating your wireless device operating correctly this time round.
Correct. So
you've been fighting that for months?
Yeah, it wasn't working under 6.06, but I loaded up 8.04 on this laptop and started working straight away. I was very happy, so I'll talk a little bit more about that later in the show.
Very good. And Graham is in the other corner with his IBM ThinkPad. What operating system are you running over there tonight?
Windows XP Service Pack 2.
Ah, fantastic. I'm with you on that one. That's what I've got here on the laptop. So if only we had the webcam going. There's five laptops in this room. It's very impressive. But nonetheless,
we've got a spare just in case.
Just in case. Yes. And if the power goes down, we're lost. But that's technology for you. Yes, very interesting week in technology. This week, Optus are coming out doing some... they're taking Telstra's position in the bullying stakes when it comes to, trying to drum up a bit of broadband activity. I think they're feeling the pinch at the moment, just quietly. But nonetheless, before we get into the main throng of things, have you got any correspondence, Dr. Ron? Anything interesting that's past your email client this week?
Yes, I've got some hellos to say because we've got new users that have joined up to the forum.
Yeah, so Mark's got a fan out there too. I don't know where you saw that email.
I did see that. Yes. Yeah, Mark, who used to be on the panel, he's still listening and he still gets fan mail.
We will get him on the show one of these days. It's just life's a bit busy at the moment. So
indeed. If you're not a registered forum user, then why not? Go to forum.techtalkradio.com.au to keep abreast of all of the discussion topics arising from each episode. So hello to the following people who've joined in the last few months. We've got Melb Guy 1 in Melbourne.
It's a giveaway, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? Sipa Whore, I think. I don't know if some of these are meant to be pronounced or not. Maybe they're not. C-P-A-H-O-R. Hello. Hello to Hugh's dad in Inverloch, down the coast.
Oh,
there.
Yes. Hugh's
dad.
We've had Hugh's dad on before. We've had his son on before.
I've had Hugh's, Hugh's dad's son.
Do you know who Hugh was?
Yes.
Mr.
Yes,
Microsoft.
I do. That's right. Yes, yes indeed. Hello, Shira. Hello, Linyongogu or something. Hello, Cisco in Oklahoma. We've had Cisco send us emails.
Has he logged into the forum now, has he?
Yeah, yeah, okay. He's a forum user. Hello to VK3XEM in Healesville. Captain Argo, Bad Cam, also known as Kiwi Cameron. Guy CLK and Mr. Hawks.
Very good.
So we've got a lot of new users there in the last few months. So sign
all
up.
All joining us on the forum.
Yeah, which is great to see.
Terrific. Yeah. Terrific. All right, let's start. I had a technical experience with none other than a major furniture empire this week. IKEA.
IKEA.
I kid you not.
Yes. Yeah, IKEA. They're the ones that ship you the pre-packed
that's it.
Furniture, and they give you one Allen key.
One Allen key. That's the extent of the technology you need for IKEA is one Allen key.
It is, when you're building it. But when you want to buy something, they actually offer a little bit more in technological terms. I logged onto their website because I wanted to get an accessory for a piece of furniture that I've got, and I thought, well, what better place to start?
Did you lose the Allen key?
Yeah, no, I need an extra shelf, Graham.
Oh, okay. I see, added shelves.
Anyway, they've got a couple of ways of which you can contact them, one of which you can't is send them an email, but you can actually type to, I think, Anna, and Anna's pretty useless.
Anna in Sweden.
What she can actually type, she just, I don't know, she obviously has an English problem, I think, because what I said was, can I get shelves for this? And she came back and said something completely, took me to the bedroom section or something. I don't know what that was all about. Anyway, I gave up.
Are you sure you're on the right website?
I was. Now, it's settled, boys.
The reply have O's with lines through them and strange letters that we don't have in our alphabet?
Not that I noticed. You think I was getting it in Swedish?
Well, you might have been. They're a Swedish company. I'm not sure.
Well, yeah, anything's possible.
Well, she understands DVD shelving because I just tried that out and it worked.
Did you?
And JD's talking to her online at the moment.
Oh, no. You got to talk to Chris. Now, Chris. This is what I was going to talk about on the radio tonight because I actually gave up on Anna because she was just not on the same wavelength that I was on. I wanted shelves and she wanted to take me to the bedroom. But having said that, I did get in touch with Chris. Now, Chris was a different character. It says you can type in your request and you chat online in real time. Now, I think, Dr. Ron, you've done this with Telstra before.
I have done this with Telstra. It worked quite well.
Yeah, well, I managed to do it with Chris. Now, the problem with Chris was he didn't listen to my questions because I've got it all printed out here in front of me. I asked him, basically, can you tell me where I get these from and da-da-da. Anyway, the answer was not forthcoming straight up, but then he read the question and then he did answer it. So all credit to IKEA to have such a great facility online. It worked really well. When I logged into it, I did notice the URL where we were going to. We're off to .jp, which is Japan. So I don't know whether Chris was whether we were routing through a big server or something in Japan. But at the end of the day, well, the message got through, which is the main thing. And it was good. He could actually access and see the store that I was interested in and check, logged in from wherever he was. Said, yeah, they've got him in stock and they're $18 or something.
So what's the difference between Anna and Chris? It was Anna a computer and Chris was a real person?
Anna's a bit of Anna's a computer and Chris was a real person. You could tell by the way that he was responding.
Fair enough. I've just brought up the IKEA website here and Anna's got a touch of the max headrooms about her.
You've noticed.
Yes.
Her head doesn't move, though. That's the problem.
It does.
It does move. Have a look.
Oh, mine didn't. Okay.
Yeah, so you're on the Mac. Give it a while.
Oh, thank you. Oh, her eyes just blinked.
There you go. All right, so that was a bit of a technological experience I thought I'd share with everybody this week.
It's good, isn't it? It's kind of the new way that customer service may well be going in the future because...
I didn't want to ring up and sit on the phone for half an hour where you get transferred to the right department. Oh, no, you're down. And I thought, no, I'll
but
try
to,
online.
To you and me, to get an answer by typing to somebody and reading what they type and typing back to them doesn't come all that natural, although some of us are getting used to it as we go along. But I don't know a single person under the age of 18 who doesn't spend half their life on MSN or Yahoo Messenger talking to their friends, and they're so used to communicating in that way that they're going to just take to this sort of stuff as they become more active consumers, like ducks to water.
Mm.
The experience I had was with Telstra, and a very similar interface to what we're looking at on the IKEA website at the moment. And I was talking to a live person in a call center, and they were able to help me. And the system worked very well.
It's great, isn't it? Yeah, it's a new way of thinking, and when people want to get on board with that and try out these new little... It looks so funny, you guys, with your laptops. Sorry.
Well, the way I thought was I've gone to their website, and it's got, you can ring this number, and I straight away thought, oh, yeah, great, and I'll be on hold for 25 minutes.
Mm.
Or just click here to start chatting live to one of our call center staff.
And want to know
within
the
a minute,
thing,
yeah, they were interacting with me.
The best thing... You don't have that goddamn IVR to wrestle
with. Oh, correct. Yes.
That's got to be winning hands down.
You don't
down
have
everywhere.
To press 7. You don't have to wait for 25 minutes being told how valuable your call is.
That's right. Sorry, Jason Sterling. You're probably listening. He'll be in next week to talk about those sort of things. But, yes, no IVR.
Well, he can defend it if he wants.
Absolutely. Now, speaking of defending things, Optus sinks the boots into Canberra this week. In relation to what, we've had a change of government, change of policy. Optus are on the way out, according to the new government, about the fibre to the node broadband thing. With the change of government, really has really stirred up a bit of a hornet's nest with Optus. Now, they're a bit concerned over the fact that they no longer think the playing field is level. It's very much tilted in Telstra's favour. What they're saying is that they need to know the access of Telstra's network so that they can then budget and plan their infrastructure so they can then bid for the fibre to the node thing. But Telstra hasn't released any of its infrastructure level.
No, they won't be wanting to release that information.
No, of course
they'll
not.
Be wanting to release interconnect information so that other people can connect to their network. But as far as equipment goes on their side of the cloud, they won't be releasing that information in a hurry.
Well, that's right. Optus CEO Paul O'Sullivan basically said this is a political decision, which it more or less is. I think we alluded to that the other day when it scrapped the $958 million contract, which was awarded to the Opel and Optus consortium. But the other thing which is that he makes a valid point is they want to actually have separation between the Telstra network, or should I say the new fibre to the node network, and the carrier's network so that no one can control prices. And of course the government, because they're chipping in $4.7 billion worth into this network as well, they become a bit of a part owner in the thing too. So, and his main concern, one of the biggest concerns, was the fact that if we don't have this separation between infrastructure and the business management, that price fixing will happen. And they were citing the credible references of Telstra and how they don't look after their resellers or anything like that, and it's a monopoly and rah, rah, rah. So take all of that on board, and that's what Optus are, this is the stink and the ruckus that they're creating. Do you think this is fair and justified?
I think it's a fair observation. There's certainly an article that you read in the news, Graeme, in regards to the debacle that we're faced with in Tasmania at the moment over this very issue.
Yeah, because other ISPs can't provide services in Tasmania cost-effectively because Telstra has a monopoly on the link between Tasmania and the mainland. And where
this is Optus's concern too.
Where Telstra has a monopoly, well, this is an example of where Telstra has a monopoly. They tend to take advantage of it, and not take a public service perspective. They take the money and run where they can.
Absolutely. And if you were competing in that same arena and the odds were not stacked evenly, would you go into that arena?
Well, the issue is you can't compete in that arena, and what we're seeing
that's exactly the point.
ISPs, like I think there was NetSpace, and what was the other one, Graeme? The one most recently,
Internode.
Yeah, they've just pulled, stopped offering new ADSL 2+ services because they can't compete.
Mm. It is, and I guess if you also look at the role that Optus play, they're probably the leading contender in the G9 consortium. That is there's two camps. There's the G9 consortium and there's the Telstra consortium when it comes to broadband in this country. And if the top dog of the G9 is sort of saying, no, this ain't quite right, then what hope do we as consumers have when it comes to getting a fair and equitable deal on our broadband without being so-called taken to the cleaners, I guess, for paying for excessive data usage? And I think even Adam Turner's mentioned this across the course of time too, that, you know, these guys, the ISPs, we're paying way too much for bandwidth in this country.
Mm, yeah. And just on the Tasmanian thing, some of the other research I was doing today, there's a second cable that's run across to Tasmania that they're currently using for power transmission, but there's optical fibre in there as well. And the current operators are concerned that if they try to compete with Telstra, Telstra will just undercut them, they'll lose their margins, and they may as well not have started.
So why invest is
exactly
the real question. So, yeah, this is poor old Tassie is starting to see what potentially the mainland will see, or most Australians will see, if we don't get some form of level playing field. Adam's actually talking to the Right Honourable Mr Conroy tonight in View from a Couch, but unfortunately they weren't talking about this, but it's very valid, you know, comments that need to be raised, I think, as time goes by.
Definitely. We'll look forward to hearing Adam speak to Mr Conroy. It'll be very good.
I also noticed that the Optus CEO was hinting that he was going to challenge the Opel consortium dumping as well.
Yeah, there was a rumour that there was going to be potentially legal action, but I think he's taking a leaf out of Phil Burgess's book, if you ask me, but that's my personal opinion on that. So, but I think we do. They all need to be held accountable, all these pollies and all these telcos and stuff like that. Speaking of keeping people accountable, eBay sellers may be restricted to cheaper items. You know, we spoke recently about how that eBay Australia are trying to make it only that you can pay via PayPal.
They're trying to force online, correct me if I'm wrong, trying to force online stores and power sellers to only accept eBay as a payment.
That's right. And we're the guinea pigs in Australia. They're trying it out here first of all. The ACCC has sort of gone, oh, I don't like the sounds of this. But nonetheless, we'll see what happens. But even just recently, another problem has emerged with eBay's decision to force customers to use its wholly owned payments subsidiary. John Dunlop, the CEO of e-commerce company, says Australian sellers that try to sell an item worth more than $10,000 run into PayPal's own $10,000 limit per transaction on funds transferred from abroad.
So they've got a $10,000 limit.
Apparently.
Didn't know that.
No. Oh. See, that, and that's the other thing, because if they channel everything down PayPal's way with this 10 grand limit, not unless PayPal are prepared to alter the limit, why would they? Don't know. But if you're selling large things like houses and boats.
Or motor cars.
Motor cars. Yeah.
Does anyone else think that that's an awful lot of money to be spending in not necessarily on purchasing something, but purchasing something in an online environment?
Well, I think you need to know a little bit about what you're buying and your seller and your buyer and all that sort of stuff. But I guess, like anything, everything's in proportion, isn't it?
Mm.
I actually noticed today when I looked at the eBay site on this that not only are you restricted to PayPal, you can pay cash on pickup. They'll let you do that.
Oh, so you can still do COD?
You can still do COD. Well, not COD through the post. You can do cash
up front.
Knock
on the door.
Mm.
Well, that's pretty good, really, when you think about what trading posts and those sort of organisations used to offer. You want to buy the baby's crib or something like that, or a big box which you're not going to post anywhere, and you put on it pickup locally. Well, why not give them the hard cash when you do the
Anyway, I do it. So.
Absolutely. In other news, spam turns 30.
Seems like
we've had spam, must be a geriatric by now, but no, it's spam turns 30. This week, the world marks the anniversary that has changed the face and given everyone so much grief in their inbox. The first known spam email was sent 30 years ago last Saturday.
By whom?
By whom? The message was sent on May the 3rd, 1978, by a marketer for the now-defunct DEC, DEC Computer Company, to around 400 people on the west coast of the United States.
Only 400?
Nah, it wasn't called spam back in those days because, you know, Monty Python were sort of not quite there in the United States by this stage, but the sender dispatched it without the... he didn't sort of mean to send it, you know what I mean? It wasn't like foistware and all that sort of stuff where they send it and hope they go for it. It was just sent without consent and without ill intent. So there you go. But things have changed, Tad, haven't they?
Now, 100 billion spam messages are sent every day. Three quarters of all the messages sent. I've got here in my notes.
Three quarters?
No, I would be thinking it would be more like 95%.
Absolutely.
100 billion.
Think of all that bandwidth that that's passing through the telcos.
Think of all the time and money and effort and resources that go into blocking 95% of the email traffic.
I was going to say, all that traffic being taken up just to hit a filter and do nothing anyway.
Well, it's maddening. Mm. It really is. Email is dying.
Well, I don't think anything's going to change in the short term, though.
It keeps me busy at work building spam filters.
I'm sure it does.
Yeah. I'm not too stressed about that.
Do you think that's a worthwhile pursuit, but, Graham? Is that a valuable use of your knowledge and expertise and
time?
Well,
it pays the bills, doesn't it?
Suppose it does. Can't argue with that.
You've also got to bear in mind, too, that a lot of security companies have made a lot of money out of spam, too.
Certainly have.
Because spam contains a lot of those nasty things these days.
Yes, I may have paid a power bill or two, but, people have built empires on this stuff, haven't they?
So rather than looking at it as a nuisance, we should be looking at it as a self-perpetuating way for IT industry to make money. Should be looking at it as an opportunity, JD. We should be seizing on it. That's right.
Absolutely. Spam. We hate it. We love it. Have you ever lost mail?
We don't really love it.
Have you ever lost mail that's come through the spam filter?
I do keep a fairly regular eye on my spam folder. Maybe once a week, I'll just flick through it, just have a very...
You're a good boy.
Just a very quick look, just to make sure nothing jumps out at me that looks like it's legitimate.
I normally find mail from my sister in there. I don't know how it gets in the spam folder.
Oh, yeah, you say on air, but yeah, secretly.
You've got a rule to send it there,
No, I don't, actually. No? I don't know. It's just the way she has her headers, I think. Anyway, but that's another
like
story.
Like somewhere.
All right. Now, the other thing which I thought was really quite humorous during the course of the week was Foxtel's boo-boo, which you alluded to in the news.
Oh, yeah, that
too.
Was in the news.
Wasn't that a doozy? Oh, let's do a software upgrade in the middle of 9:15 movie prime time.
Yeah, it's not...
Do you really think they would have thought that when you put this upgrade through that it's going to disconnect people and they're going to be furious because they're in the midst of watching the telly or whatever it is?
I don't think they really thought about it at all. It's one of those things that, it sort of happened without much thought going into it.
Yeah, but for those of you who missed the beginning, the pay TV operator confirmed that it sent software updates to subscriber set-top boxes at 9:12 the other night.
9:12 p.m. Right,
and which interrupted viewing for between 15 minutes and half an hour for those who have paid for the service. So if you're in the midst of watching, they could have done it at 7 o'clock.
Yep. Traditionally, you do this sort of stuff at 3 or 4 in the morning and you disrupt as few people as possible.
Well, I guess you can look on the bright side. It was 3 or 4 in the morning somewhere in the world.
Because you could do it at that...
Nowhere in Foxtel service area.
You could do it at that time. Everybody's set-top boxes would be switched on, even if the televisions were switched off. So there's no reason why you couldn't still do a software update remotely to a set-top box.
The other thing was it dumped everybody's preset...
preset
programs as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So if you if you'd set up to record something the next day, it did the software update and dropped them all. So
the chances are the people that have Foxtel anyway are probably all on holidays and they've set their boxes up to record something. Is there any sporting events on that are coming up they didn't want people to record? Because this was their IQ box or something, isn't it?
I think it was everything.
The IQ is the standard one, the
standard receiver, wasn't it?
I don't have Foxtel. I don't know much about it.
I have to double check that.
Mm. Okay, we've got enough laptops. We can have a bit of a squiz and see what the deal is there.
The IQ is the one that records everything, though.
Yeah, the IQ is the one with the hard disk recorder in it, yeah.
It's the TiVo of the Foxtel world.
That's right.
Okay, good. All right, Microsoft, those guys, I think they've given up on Yahoo. Did you read this on the course of the weekend?
They pulled the plug on the offer.
Yeah, Microsoft is with... Yeah, it was, really. Mm. Microsoft has withdrawn its proposal to acquire Yahoo. Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer said in a letter to Yahoo, which was made public last Friday, I think. There you go. So there it is, end of Microhoo. Well, I guess watch this space now. Who knows, that might come back in some form of reincarnation or someone. Someone will chase someone down the street.
They really wanted Yahoo as well, because they wanted to compete against the big G. They wanted an online presence that was already set up in that space, in that search space.
Yes, exactly. We're going to be talking about brand names later on in the show tonight. Millward Brown, a fairly sizable US company, and they've released a very interesting document on the top 100 most powerful brands of 2008. So who do you think's the top dog?
I'd be guessing the big G would be pretty close to the top.
Of all companies? Okay, well, we'll watch this space and we'll come back to it. And
Pepsi used to sit up there pretty high at one point.
What about Coca-Cola? Mm.
Well, Pepsi worldwide is much bigger than Coke.
Mm. All will be revealed. I have the list here in front of me. I will go through that later on in the show. So, yes, Google, maybe. Maybe
the big M,
yeah. So Microsoft can't quite compete with Google.
What about the big golden arches, big M?
Oh, that one.
That'd have to rate
absolutely. We all love
our
fast food, don't we? It's got to be there. You put one of those up on any corner, and it just makes money for you.
Yeah, license to print money.
Yeah. All right. The other interesting thing, which Graham, you've probably got something to say about this. What happened to our Service Pack 3 update for Windows XP?
Yeah, Graham.
Yeah, what Service Pack 3 update? There is no Service Pack 3 for XP. It's No, it's gone. No.
Move along, nothing to see is the official response.
They pulled it at the last minute. It is now. It turns out that at the very last minute, they'd already released it to manufacturing. They were about to release it to the web so we could all get our hands on it. And they discovered that it was incompatible with an obscure piece of accounting or retail management software. So the sort of point of sale software that you might run on in a shop with
a great cash
register
or something like that.
Microsoft Dynamics.
What?
It was incompatible with one of their own products, and they didn't discover it until the eve of release to web.
Well, that's a good bit of research, isn't it? Wouldn't you think you'd try it on all your products and brands before
you'd think they might try it on their own products, but that one seems to have escaped their attention. And, apparently Vista Service Pack 1 is affected by the same problem, so they've stopped the automatic distribution of it through the Windows Update process. And, on hold at the minute until they figure it out.
Does this mean we're going to have Vista Service Pack 1A and Vista and XP Windows Service Pack 3A like we had, I think, on... One operating system had that.
What you're thinking about is NT4 Service Pack 6A.
There was an A there somewhere.
Which Microsoft only managed to test when running as an administrator.
So Microsoft...
and didn't realise that all their services wouldn't work anymore.
Right. NT4 Service Pack 6 was out for about a day or 2 days.
Oh, no, it was out for about a week.
Was it? Yeah, and then 6A suddenly appeared.
Yeah. I doubt that there'll be a Service Pack 3A for Windows XP. I think there'll just be a hotfix that'll get rolled into it and it'll just be called Service Pack 3.
Because it hasn't actually been released, not like Service Pack 6 back in NT days.
I don't think it'll be anything that dreadful. The hotfix might just install after the Service Pack does and it won't be a big problem.
We're going to take a break. We're going to come back after the break with Adam's View from the Couch. He's going to speak to the Honourable Minister about digital TV, get the real answers as to when things are going to be turned off and switched around and all that sort of stuff. That's after our break. And then after that, we're going to be talking to Graham Henley. He's the man to speak to if you lose your data by corruption, potentially.
He's a security expert, isn't he?
He is. We're going to find out all about that after about two breaks.
Hi, I'm Rico Malver, Managing Director of Microsoft Research in Redmond in the U.S. Be sure to tune in to Tech Talk Radio soon when I'll be talking about the future of technology.
With the federal election approaching, the pollies are doing everything in their power to actually get their message across.
You change it into Little Einstein just to make it feel happier, but he still couldn't get rid of him. You know?
Wonder if it's going
to
be like Vista.
Why are people standing in thunderstorms with iPods on?
Did you just say instication?
I think that's what I just said.
That's all right. Go on.
I have a cold.
If it is 10%, make everyone pay 10% more and then have the government enforce that they have X amount of green power done by a certain date.
Have you considered a career in politics, Mark? I think that's a fantastic idea.
Being the extremely cynical person that I am...
Look at the map, you idiots.
I'd like to think that it's in my bones.
I do.
I use the force to a large extent.
Yeah, give people understand you. It's the stick and the carrot, isn't it?
That's it.
And this way is both,
I reckon. Don't eat the carrot, we'll beat you with the stick.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
You are. Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McComb. The panel this evening, Graham Callaghan, Dr. Wrong, and Justin Dummel. He's in tonight too. We've got everyone here. It's wonderful. Adam Turner's here in spirit. He's on the internet. He's on my computer to my left, reminding me to read out this to you. Last week, you, being me, said that after his view to a couch, view from the couch, that you might thought the Nokia store was supposed to work with mobile phones. It does. A handful of high-end Nokia phones let you buy tracks over the air and download them directly to your phone, but you can't stream music to your phone. Why not? That'd be good, wouldn't it? I'd love to have the phone so you can listen to the radio while you're on the tram.
Think of the bandwidth that would be involved.
Yeah.
It would cost you billions of dollars.
Well, if you're with one particular carrier, yeah. Yes. So, there you go. Yes, you can use it. I wonder if
only if you've got a super duper U-Boot Nokia top end phone.
Yeah. Well, you actually could stream if you've got a web browser. What if you click on the streaming icon for us, for example? Would that come out your phone audio jack?
It probably would. I don't see what wouldn't.
If it's got the right plugins and so forth, yeah.
Yeah. Well, there you go. I must try it one day. I'll see if I can log into us and.
When the iPhone comes out in July, I'll be there.
The iPhone? Yes. When do you? What rumours have you heard recently about iPhones?
Oh, I think you've probably already covered them all, but 6th of June, thereabouts, the developers' conference, it's probably going to be announced that there's a 3G phone, maybe.
Maybe.
And then July, when the Apple store in New South Wales and a couple of other centres in New South and Victoria open.
Are you looking forward to the one in Chadstone down here? We've got a suburb, which is a shopping centre here in Melbourne. That's called Chadstone. And they're rumoured to have an iStore going in there.
Yes, which no one's really confirming or denying, but apparently they are. And there's an Apple store in Shopping Town in Doncaster now, which is very nice.
Really?
A third-party one.
I should get out more often, shouldn't I?
Yeah.
All right. Adam caught up with the Right Honourable during the course of the week at a doorstop, I think, judging by the sound of where he was. It might have been the pub, actually. Hey, but let me not draw conclusions there. Just in relation to digital television, it's been an on-again, off-again debacle in this country over the past... Well, we've had digital TV since the year 2000. That's 8 years now. And what have we got?
No, not a lot.
We've got Foxtel ramping up HD because we can't get any multiple channels and stuff like that because we had to protect Mr. Packett's Foxtel and Telstra's Foxtel and whoever owns it these days. So, we're at the sort of, we're still lagging behind the rest of the world. Look at the UK going forward in leaps and bounds, multiple channels everywhere.
One of my high definition channels on my digital television the picture looks all pixelated and grungy and horrid.
Is that just
normal or?
Nah.
Is it just me being picky or is this something that
we'll talk about that after this.
Good.
That'd be good. Anyway, here's Adam's view from the couch for this week.
Adam Turner's view from the couch on Tech Talk Radio.
With all the confusion around the shutdown dates for analog television, I decided it was time to go straight to the source. I cornered Communications Minister Stephen Conroy in Melbourne last week after a press conference to ask him exactly what is happening with digital television. Originally, it seemed the analog television switch-off would start in 2009 and be finished by 2013. But Conroy's recent announcements made it seem like the process wouldn't start until 2013. So here's the conversation I had with Conroy, which shed some light on the situation. The other voice you hear is Age business journalist Jesse Hogan. Just as some background, Whitehaven is a town in northern England that is the pilot area for the UK switchover to digital-only television. Now, here's what Conroy had to say for himself.
Is it possible that it could be cut off at 09? Is it possible that it could be that early? No.
I'll be making a further announcement on that date later in the year after we finish the consultation. So no one should work on the basis that that will be the actual
beginning. But it will definitely be by 013.
The final will be by 013.
And that's the final for the whole country?
The whole country.
So by 014, nowhere, region, metro...
It'll be switched off. Like CDMA, it'll be switched off.
And so is it going to be a tiered thing where the cities go out first?
We'll probably start some regional centres first. Like, say, a Tasmanian market. I mean, my family's from Whitehaven. Yeah. So the British government picked Whitehaven as the target switch off date. So I literally was talking to my uncles, my nana, my aunts about how it's going.
So
I'm getting feedback on the ground about how it's actually gone pretty well.
Yeah.
So we'll do something like a Mildura or a Tasmania. Yeah. There's actually quite a few people putting up their hands in regional centres saying, we want to go first.
Yeah.
Quite genuine. There are people saying, hey, we're actually ready to go now. So we'll be starting a few trials in a couple of regional centres, and then we'll begin to roll it out across the country.
Yeah.
And we'll have a time frame like that.
So is that by the end of this year, you should have a better idea of when the beginning
We'll actually have the dates.
Okay, so by Christmas, we'll have a solid date that says...
This place.
For the whole country?
Yes.
Okay.
That's the plan. That is what we've announced. We said by the end of this year, we will actually have set out the dates and the places. And then I'll be able to make the adjustment to that 09 date to fit that.
And has there been any consideration of hardware subsidies either for people in low socioeconomic areas or multi-dwelling units?
The multi-dwelling units is one of my serious challenges. Okay, the first meeting of the industry task force on this included a new member, which was from multi-dwelling units. And so we've got them in and we're sitting down talking with them. I mean, there's plenty of challenges, and they face these challenges in the UK and everywhere else as well. So that is a very tough issue because you actually require, according to Australia, you actually require them to vote.
Yeah.
Okay? But by 2013, if they haven't made the decision to actually implement this, they have no TV.
Yeah.
Okay? So that's the first thing. Secondly, we've written to the building codes to begin the process of saying any new multi-unit dwelling got to be included to go digital. So we're beginning that process. So this is the multi-unit dwelling is actually the toughest of all the issues. In terms of subsidy to handsets, in the UK, what they found was that they sat down and said, look, what will be that sort of size of that target? And they made an allocation, and it was much, much less. The community campaign that they actually engaged in, literally in shopping centres, was far more successful than anticipated. So at this stage, we want to see how that goes before we have to actually go down a path like that.
So are we still on track for multi-channel standard definition in 2009?
Absolutely. There's an EPG out. And the Freeview box, equivalent to the UK Freeview box, is on track. It's very, very exciting where they're at. Genuinely, I had a briefing on it yesterday. It's very exciting.
So this Freeview box is what you see is the one in every pot sort of thing. It's what will get people across the line.
Well, this will get people... this will give you new content. This will give you effectively about 15 channels. If you look at the current channel, the standard definition channel, the high-end channel, you've got ABC 1, ABC 2, they want ABC 3, you've got SBS 1, 2, and they want 3. So, I mean, you're looking at about 15 channels when you start adding it all up. I mean, this is a pretty significant development. The free-to-airs have dragged their feet for most of the last 10 years. They're really behind it now. And they've actually decided, no, we better get onto this. Once I set the date, they realised we were serious. We've been dragging their feet, delaying it. Now they're serious. So it's very exciting.
Are there any solid decisions on ABC 3, or is it still one of those?
The triennial funding for the ABC comes up in the next budget. So what I'd say is that's the time when ABC, I'm sure, put forward a bid for a whole range of new things.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Well, Auntie does do it best, I reckon, but there you go. There's some definitive answers. Christmas, maybe.
Mr. Conroy
didn't
was
say
rather,
which year, but
rather jovial.
He was.
Yes.
Very convivial attitude.
Yes. Anyway, thank you, Adam. That was lovely. Now, we know multi-channeling starts at the end of this year. Multi-channeling, for those of you who aren't familiar with digital television, you actually get a few extra channels up your sleeve when you buy your set-top box, and you can flick. That's what ABC2 is at the moment. ABC2 is fantastic. It replays a lot of content that you may have missed on the ABC1 channel. And, of course, we've got high definition, which
looks pixelated and grungy and horrible. So I've got to wait till 2013, do I, before they're going to start throwing bandwidth at it properly?
Well, no, they won't. This is the thing. This is where it comes down to being quality versus content.
Right.
You're going to be seeing, because the bandwidth, the actual pipe which comes from the TV transmitter to your house is only so big.
Yep.
Now, obviously, the more you shove into that pipe, the more you have to compress it to fit it all in so that it gets, add water at the other end and out she comes and looks sort of hopefully somewhat decent. Now, that's how it works. Now, high definition takes a lot of space. Mm. It's four times traditionally the size of a standard definition channel. So this is where you're now going to be looking at the television networks. Do they want to have more standard def channels running more advertising content to to fill their coffers as opposed to get rid of the multi-channeling and run a really good high definition channel? You've got to be kidding, really, don't you? You work out which way they're going to go.
So what's the point of high definition if it's going to look grungy and horrible? And surely the point of high definition is it should look good.
Graham, the point is it will raise revenue.
Graham, that is a very good question. And people sitting out there expecting just that because they've bought their lovely big screen plasmas and LCD sets expecting to see amazing pictures, I personally think may be a little disappointed. You're going to have to go to the video library and get your Blu-ray discs for that. Because I don't think you'll see it on free-to-air. And, of course, the other thing, too, is sporting events would just look so fantastic in high definition.
Oh, yes.
It would be terrific to see that. Now, for those of you who do have digital television at the moment, who's noticed the quality difference between ABC1 and ABC2? There's a classic example of what happens there where most of the bandwidth is thrown at the primary channel, and then you've got this poor second happening.
Mostly in the audio, I found, on ABC2.
So, there you go. So, there you go. You can see it already in some of your pictures that are floating around already. Anyway.
It's a bit sad, isn't it?
Heard of this thing called TiVo? We spoke briefly about it last year. Actually, I think we might have spoken in depth about it last year.
Mm.
Well, it looks like Engine's on the outer now. They're having a bit of a rethink about where TiVo's going to go.
And weren't Engine teaming up with Channel 7?
They were.
So what's happened? They've had a rethink.
Well, yes. Channel 7 are trying to get it out into the market before the Beijing Olympics kicks off. And they've sort of done a bit of a... They've had to redo their maths because they want to charge people a $500 upfront fee and then $10 to $12 a month subscription for a TiVo. And they've done a few surveys to see if people are likely to pay for that. And guess what?
Ba-boom.
Yeah, exactly. So as a result...
Zero interest.
As a result, they've been looking in other areas to cut their costs.
So
and
why do you need
there.
A subscription for a TiVo? Can't it just receive the off-air channels as they are?
Good question.
Yes, it can. The subscription, I'm just checking while we're chatting, but the subscription will actually be for the programming guide.
Right.
The same as Ice TV, I think, operating out of South Australia. Most Mac users...
So we're back to this programming guide debacle where you're not allowed to tell people what's going to be on next.
Correct.
Hmm.
But well, I mean, the programming guide that's on digital TV now gives you, a couple of hours ahead, but the Ice TV... just
But it should give you a week ahead.
Yeah, well, this is months ahead.
It's radio, JD. Mm. It's radio. Sorry. What's come up on your screen?
It has. So Ice TV is an equivalent for Mac users and others that use the iTV system. And if I can just quickly find out how much it costs, I can give you a comparison to TiVo. But essentially what you're doing is you're buying the service. There you go, $13 a month. You're buying the service to get the program guide. And so that you can program your TiVo to take the recording when you want it to.
But then Channel 7 put the programs on at random times anyway. It bears no relation to the program guide.
Theoretically, the program guide will update as Channel 7 changes their mind.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Ah.
It's dynamic.
So when they say it starts at 8:30 and it starts at 8:42 and doesn't finish till 9:43, you won't miss the last 10 minutes?
Potentially, that's correct.
The way that it's supposed to work is that you don't actually say, I want to start recording at 9:30 and stop at 10:30. You say, I want you to record ER tonight.
Right.
And it will figure out when it starts, when it ends, and record it for
ER's
you.
ER's on Channel 9. That's good.
Whatever. I don't watch TV. There's nothing on.
There is also this potential of ad skipping, which people have talked about over the course of time. Which,
well, like when media player up, when you record something, just click and drag for 2 seconds and you don't have to watch any ads.
Yes.
That's really good.
Yes. Well, I think you can't quite skip the ads, but you can go very fast through them on a TiVo.
That's right. Yeah, shuffle play through them.
Yeah. So that's one of the other advantages of it. Because when you think Channel 7 are going to lose revenue if people aren't going to watch their ads, you're going to get it, you've got to recoup that somehow through your $10 or $12 a month rental when it comes back. So you've got a lot to look forward to as well. So I wonder if they'll do a software upgrade in the middle of the AFL. That's the other thing too, actually, with the TiVo.
They'd be the popular, wouldn't they?
Absolutely. Like yeah. With the
opening ceremony of the Olympics, I reckon.
Oh, yeah. Version 2's here. Let's put it out now, just in time for the Olympic. Oh, it's happening here. But the other thing too is the TV stations can actually control what you can and can't record on a TiVo. They can put a little flag that comes down. So when the grand final's on, when the opening ceremony,
record this.
It will actually say to the little TiVo device saying, no, don't record it on your internal hard drive. That won't stop you recording it on an external hard drive, but it will probably stop you recording it on an internal.
On the TiVo,
but you'll just get it chipped, won't you, like they used to do with the PS2?
No, you'll just go down and buy one of those ones from, you know, JB Hi-Fi or one of the others,
like
where
the
Beyond like
Wiz or the Digitech or
Those ones, yeah, and skip the TiVo altogether.
Mm, fantastic.
So what's the point? There isn't one.
No.
Okay.
When you've got the digital TV.
Point, well, there's no point in the TiVo. I think that's where we started, wasn't right. it? Yeah, people don't get to bother.
We've proved it now.
We've gone full circle. Anyway, when your TiVo crashes and you want to get that television program off that you desperately want, sorry, I'm looking for a link here, who are you going to call? Well, you get in touch with people that actually are experts in recovery of hard drives and things like that.
Okay.
You've used them? We've all used them. I've tried one.
Yeah, when your hard drive crashes and you can't read it anymore.
Yeah.
And you've tried all the tricks and when you put it in the fridge and it still goes ka-clunk, 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 ka-clunk.
Why do you put it in the fridge?
I don't know. There was
no wonder it's going ka-clunk.
Dr. Ron, you can speak. No, you put phones in fridges.
Some faults are temperature sensitive.
Ah, that's very true.
Yeah.
Very true.
But no, when all of that fails and you still can't get your data back.
Who are you going
to
call?
You have to go off to these people and they have special tools and special software and sometimes they have special equipment and even clean rooms so they can take the drive apart without it just being destroyed.
Yeah, well, we're going to chat to a man who knows all about this, Graham Henley. He's from a company called GetData. We'll get him on the phone in a minute and have a bit of a chat about it. And by the way, Adam just said that Ice TV can't tell if a show starts late. So I don't know which EPG it's using or whatever, how it works. But
it
nonetheless,
can't tell if a show starts late. What is the point? There is no point. It will not work here, will it?
No.
It will not work here.
Let's ponder that, shall we? Time for a break.
Compelling.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
Judicious.
The question is really whether young people particularly are addicted to being connected to other people all the time.
Historical.
Today is a very important day in Australia's history. This is the day, the 6th of October, 2006, that life in Australia will be changed forever.
Caring.
I know as a parent, I would often say to my children, you've just spoken to this person for 8 hours at school, how can you sit online and chat to them for another 5 hours?
You heard of road rage? What about web rage?
They should be wearing a mask and carrying a gun.
Relations between Telstra and the federal government have been extremely strained almost from the moment Sol Trujillo became chief executive.
Optus had, again, had quite a good quarter, but its 3G service is very low profile at the moment.
And the Queen's got an iPod.
Betty's got one.
Yeah.
I wonder what she listens to. She'll probably listen to us.
An unexpectedly high number of voters swamped the system. Well, what did they expect?
Controversial.
Less attention is paid to the equally interesting question, should journalists blog?
Magical.
And I've got some residual powers.
Ambitious.
High-speed broadband, it's available in most of Asia as well as being in the rest of the world. Let's just make sure that we can get it in Australia this year, not next.
Religion.
Talking of the Roman Catholics, I have been on Vatican Radio.
Comedy.
And you put the date on ePray, it goes and you get a whole service. Just on a,
how does it go?
It goes.
Insightful, entertaining, and informative. Tech Talk Radio. More than just technology.
It's a strictly rehearsed and finely polished program.
Have you heard something on Tech Talk Radio worth talking about? Are you looking to share your technical dilemmas or opinions with like-minded Tech Talk Radio listeners? Well, now you can. Introducing the Tech Talk Radio web forum. Visit forum.techtalkradio.com.au and join our community. It's free and on a web browser near you. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Yeah, welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. Andrew McComb here. Dr. Ron, Graham Callaghan, and Jason Dunlop, all here, present and accounted this evening. It's very nice having everybody in the studio. It makes a great change.
Nice and cosy.
It is, isn't it?
Mm.
Anyway, data backup. Have you had a crisis, Dr. Ron, where you've gone, oh no, and you've gone, oh, this is a problem?
No, data recovery is overrated. We don't really need to. No. I jest. It's very, very important. And we all have, everyone who's worked in the industry is all, well, I think we've all experienced that horrible, just about to have a car crash feeling.
Yes, it's terrible.
You've just discovered that something very, very bad's happened in a data loss sense, and you just suddenly
your hard disk makes that clunk sound.
Have a lot of customers, I would have thought, that have been down that.
Oh, yes, I've had customers, but I've been there myself as well, not just customers.
Well, we have Graham Henley on the phone. He's from a company called Get Data. You can visit his website, getdata.com.au. But Graham's had many years' experience in recovering data. In fact, he's done it professionally for organisations like the Australian Federal Police. So if someone knows how to recover stuff off a drive, I would think it'd be this man. Graham, you've had plenty of years' experience in this sort of stuff, I can gather.
Hello, gents. Yes, I've been doing data recovery work in various forms for probably about 15 years now.
And tell me about the, I guess, from a personal point of view, you'd probably be looking at developing software to help the mums and dads, the small businesses, potentially the large businesses, to get their software back when you hear those funny noises or you accidentally erase it too. I guess that's probably one of the problems too.
Yes, look, that's what my company does now. Get Data was formed as a software development company. So for a living, we go to work each day and we write software. And really, from my background and the background of some of the partners that I work with, it really came from that data recovery field. So when we first started the company, that was the basis. We sat down and we wrote some data recovery software that was could be used by the home user, the mums and dads, quite straightforwardly. If they have a disaster, like they delete files or format their hard drive or something goes wrong with their hard drive, it enables the home user or business users to get their data back.
Is it really that simple? Is it really easy to do it? Because there's a lot of different sort of parameters, I would have thought, to actually pull data back off a drive, especially if you've erased it or the machine's making some strange noises.
Yeah, look, it's... It ranges from some very simple things can go wrong with a hard drive to enable you to lose the data, right to some very complex things. And when you talk about data recovery, there's really two types. There's data loss that can be solved with a software solution, and then there's your physical hardware recovery, which is when your hard drive is a mechanical device. It's like a car. It gets old and it wears out. And so when you have physical problems, that's when you actually need to send your hard drive out to a service place that will start replacing those components and getting the data off the drive that way.
Graham, what can we do if we make a really simple, stupid, dumb mistake? If we suddenly delete 500 photographs of our children and our family and realise that we've got that setting turned off that says put things in the recycle bin, and just suddenly we think, oh no, you get that terrible sinking feeling in the pit of your stomach, I've just deleted everything. What's the very first thing that people should be doing in order to try and recover that data?
Well, essentially, the best thing to do is not to panic, because the data is still out there on the drive.
His famous last words.
Well, the principle of data recovery. Essentially, when Bill Gates sat down, he wrote Microsoft Windows. The way he wrote Windows was so that everything happens really quickly. No one wants to be sitting around waiting for things to happen on your computer. So really, at the start of any sort of storage disk, there's this table. And in the newer operating systems, they call it the master file table. And it's basically like a big spreadsheet that points out to where all the files are on the disk. So when you're in Windows and you actually delete a file, all you're really doing is going to that spreadsheet and saying, let's remove that entry. It's like tearing the index out of a book. But you can actually still go out to the data on the drive and still find it out there on the drive and recover it. So the most important thing is don't panic and don't start writing information to the drive, because as soon as you start changing the contents of the hard drive, then there's a good chance you could write data on top of some of the deleted material, and once it gets overwritten, then it's gone for good.
So what can we do, Graham? Is there software that we need to have pre-installed to in anticipation of this sort of situation, or is this something that we can do straight away?
Yeah, our software is called Recover My Files. You can go to recovermyfiles.com and download it. And it's really designed so that after a data loss, or you can preempt this thing by having Recover My Files installed in the first instance, but it can be installed after a data loss and used just as effectively. So you download the software. It allows you to run it on your computer, and it goes through its various types of recovery searches that it does, and it, in the results screen, it brings up the results and it shows you in the results screen, and enables you to click on the files that are found and preview the content. And once you can preview those pictures and you can preview the documents and read those things that you've lost, then you know your data's out there and you know it can be recovered.
Graeme, I've had cause to recover in previous times, and the methods that I've used seem to take a long time, and it presents a lot of information which you go, my goodness, what is abc123.tmp type sort of files? Your software, is it still cumbersome like that, or are we starting to streamline it and say, well, the ones which are partially erased, I can't recover those, but here are the ones that I can get back? Is it, what's the sort of process? Does it take a long time still to recover a drive?
It can take a long time. It really depends on the depth of search you do. When I mentioned there's that spreadsheet at the start of the disk, it's very fast to go out to that spreadsheet, look for the deleted files that that spreadsheet contains, and bring them all back. That search can be done, and a drive that's been accidentally formatted, for example, you can have that drive completely back within 15 minutes of searching. Now, when you go further down the depths of searching, you can go right down to a very tiny storage unit, a sector level, and then you can scan an entire disk at a sector level looking to dig up every last fragment of information that's on there. Now, if you're searching a terabyte drive at a sector level, it's going to take a long time, there's no doubt about it. So it really depends on the type of search you do. In our software, Recover My Files, we concentrated heavily on getting the preview capability in there. So that when you run the search, you know what is on there can be found because you can actually see the photos and the documents in front of you.
So, Graeme, just taking a different approach, I deal with secondhand computers a fair bit, and if I'm going to sell one of my hard drives or one of my computers, how many do I need to zero-level my drive, or is there some process I need to do to ensure that people can't recover data?
Yeah, look, there is a process. It's very, very important. If you're recycling a drive or handing a drive off to friends or basically, you know, getting rid of some sort of electronic storage media, you really have to protect yourself by wiping the drive. I mentioned before when data gets overwritten, then it's permanently destroyed. So there are a whole range of wiping programs out there available. And basically what they do is they go to the disk and they start writing zeros or different characters across the drive, and once that information has been overwritten, it can't be recovered. Well, actually, it can be recovered, but what you're recovering is zeros.
Graeme, it's Graeme here. What happens if the Recover My File software doesn't bring back the data you're looking for? What if the drive's making a strange sound or something like that? Is there anything that can still be done after that to get data back?
Yeah, look, in some cases it is a hardware problem. You can try the software. If the software hasn't worked for you, then with Recover My Files, the idea is you try it, you see what it can recover, and then if you've located the documents you're looking for, then you can purchase the activation key and save the files. Now, obviously, if the drive's got mechanical errors and the computer can't see the hard drive, then that's where you've got to make the decision, okay, do I want to go out to a data recovery service company and send them my physical drive and have them pull it apart and see what data can come back? Now, obviously, that's more of a time-consuming and a more expensive option. But we do that for our customers. If our data recovery software solution doesn't work for them, then we partner with some hardware data recovery service people who can do the pulling apart of drives.
Data can be stored on other things apart from the old magnetic hard drive, such as flash memory and chips in our phones and things like that. What happens then? Because we're not talking about ones and zeros stored on a drive. We're talking about information stored in flash memory. If you accidentally erase that, I would have thought that'd be gone. Is that the case, Graeme?
Yeah, look, there's hundreds of different types of storage devices out there these days. Our software, we have recovermyfiles.com, is developed for computer hard drives. We have a separate product called Recover My Photos, which can be downloaded from recovermyphotos.com, and that really looks after that whole range of digital photograph storage media. If you're talking about a chip, an EEPROM that's programmed into a phone, then that's a completely different specialised field. There is still, it's still possible to get some information off in those circumstances. For example, law enforcement agencies are developing techniques to extract information from chips out of mobile phones, for example, for obviously obvious investigation reasons. So it can be done, but it's a much more specialised field, and it really requires you to send that EEPROM to a specialised service provider.
Now, talking of flash memory and USB devices and so on, you said earlier that one of the important things is not to change the drive that you're trying to recover the software from. So if you've deleted files on your C drive, the last thing you want to do is install a new program on your C drive. Would it be advisable to download Recover My Files to a USB stick or something like that and install it there to recover the data from your C drive?
You don't want to overwrite something,
You don't want to overwrite your photos with the recovery program. That's not going to help you.
Yeah, look, that's certainly an option. You really have to weigh up your situation. Many people accidentally format their hard drive. They've lost all their data. They need to get access to it, so they reinstall Windows. Now, Windows has a footprint of, 300 or 400 megabytes, depending on which version and which options you install. Now, if you're downloading Recover My Files, it only has a footprint of 10 megabytes. So in comparison, really, the risk is quite small. But if you want to follow best procedure, then yes, you should take every opportunity that you have to reduce the risk of writing to that drive. And that means not using Windows and not installing software to it. So usually, if you want to really take the best course of attack, the best thing is to remove that storage device and then connect it to another computer as a secondary drive. And that really reduces the chance of allowing Windows to write to the drive, reduces the chance of the user accidentally writing to the drive, and allows you to run all your data recovery software and procedures from the good computer's C drive, if you like.
Generation Y, Graham, obviously they're into iPods and the likes. Music would obviously play a fairly large part of their life. And as a result, I guess more and more of us are heading off to iTunes and those sort of environments where they only let you really download the track once when you pay for it. What happens if you've got your life savings worth of kids spend a lot of money on music these days. What happens when the iPod comes to grief or something like that? Can we retrieve information is there a way of getting that back?
Yeah, look, about 18 months ago, or probably nearly 2 years ago, we started getting inundated with people trying to recover their songs from their iPod. Now, Recover My Files, which is our main program, does it, but we specifically went out and wrote a program called Recover My iPod, which you can find at recovermyipod.com. And that program is purely to enable users to get back their music from a failed iPod. Again, there's different scenarios when the iPod fails. A lot of the time people accidentally sync an empty library to their iPod full of songs, which means they all disappear. In that instance, they can be quite easily recovered. But there's also there's the componentry between the iPod casing and the actual hard drive inside, and we accept quite a lot of iPods into our office, and you find a lot of sand in them when people take them to the beach, for example. There's all sorts of scenarios. A lot of them end up in the bath or get submerged. But the hard drive inside an iPod is usually quite they've got a lot of tolerance, and they're usually in pretty good condition. So probably at least 95% of the time we're successful in getting all the data off an iPod.
It's funny hearing about the sand. I was thinking about
finding
crumbs and Vegemite sandwich crusts inside the VCR and things like that when you pull that apart for repairs. I was going to ask you, Graham, about the resilience, I guess, of different types of storage media. We're seeing storage when it comes to hard disks, for example, like just going through the roof. Like I can remember when I had my first computer, which was probably coming up to a few years ago now, 20 years ago, we had 20...
That's sitting on the desk in front of you.
It is. It's spot on. We had like 20 megabyte hard disks and 40 megabyte hard disks, and a friend of mine got an 80 megabyte hard disk, and we all said, what do you want 80 megabytes for? I'm just wondering, as this technology is getting smaller and smaller and our storage capacity is ever increasing, are you noticing an increase in the number of like warranty returns, the number of failures on discs, or has the market really matured and you think that maybe they're as good as they're ever going to be, these sorts of devices?
I think generally, from my own experience, the hard drive storage devices have actually got better over time. In the last 10 years, they're a lot more reliable than they ever were, even of the sizes that have got out to 1 gigabyte. However, you do find those devices used in... there's a lot of external drives, for example, where you plug in via a USB. Now, the external drives, they run the FAT32 file system, which can be a bit more unstable when you get the larger drives. But also, because they're external, they're more prone to be knocked, bumped, dropped, spilt on, and all sorts of other strange things. Or you get some sort of connection error where the connection has upset the file system. So generally speaking, the physical components are a lot better than they used to be. But still, there's many ways to lose your data.
Yeah, they're a lot more shockproof, I guess, and you can certainly, as you say, you can kick them around a lot more than you used to. We always used to have to stand disks up the right way and have computer towers standing up the right way, or sometimes the disks would start to fail and do strange things, but they're pretty resilient these days, I guess.
Yeah, there was also there was a period where drives started increasing in speed, and they were actually getting quite hot. And they've really worked out a lot more of the cooling systems around a hard drive these days too, which can increase their reliability long term.
What about RAID arrays and things like that? Obviously, businesses would potentially use those, Graeme. Now, if you're not running a RAID as in as a backup system, but if you're running it to increase your hard drive capacity to speed processes up, can you recover if something goes wrong on one particular drive or something like that? Can you recover from that sort of dilemma?
Yeah, look, the RAID arrays can be recovered. There's techniques and software out there available to do it. Recover My Files doesn't currently do it, but our next version will specifically address that issue because we're, again, we get a lot of requests to recover failed RAID arrays, particularly when you have a redundancy on one drive and you have more than one drive fail at a time. But RAID array, it's very possible to get the data back. It makes it more complicated because a single file can be split up over two or three or four or five drives in order to get the speed. So it's a matter about getting all those drives talking to each other properly so that you can manage to pick up those pieces of the individual file and then recover the data.
I was just going to ask, Graeme, if you could explain in simple terms what a RAID array is, but I think you've covered it there. It's essentially a data being distributed across more than one drive. Is that something that's cost-effective now for small business, or is it still very much in the hundreds of thousands of dollars investment area?
Oh, look, you can buy very large hard drives for very little cost these days. So having a backup, really, it's quite an easy solution. You can buy a terabyte hard drive quite cheaply, and really, if you're filling up a terabyte full of user-created data, then you've obviously got some people who are doing a lot of work for you because that's actually a considerable effort. So, that's often the case.
One of the things I've always thought, the higher you fly, the further you fall when it comes to disk storage. And I really do think that the simplest and easiest thing for looking after your data is make a copy of it, back it up somewhere. It'll save you all the heartache. But my question, Graeme, is all backup software the same? Like, is there some better than others? Like, if you buy a $50 piece as opposed to a $5,000 piece, are you really seeing that much difference in the technology that those vendors are providing to recover data?
Yeah, look, when you're spending a lot of money on backup software, you're really doing it for having redundant systems. So you're able to, you've got an office environment, say, and the office environment is not disturbed in any way and just keeps working as they go, and the backup is taken seamlessly, and if there's a disaster of some sort, then that backup can be seamlessly integrated back into the workplace. Now, that's why you spend a lot of money. So it really depends, on what you're trying to address. If you're a home user or a small business, then, there's very cheap and very, very effective software solutions out there. The thing you have to be really careful of is that because there are so many players in the backup industry, you've got, when you're looking at software to create a backup, you have to look at flexibility. You have to think about whether that company is going to be around in a few years' time. You don't want to have a situation where you've got a file format where it's not supported anymore, so you've struggled to get the data out of that. So flexibility, conversion of your backup file format into other formats, and really, if you create it, can I get it back easily?
We've been talking on the program a bit about operating systems other than Windows. We've got a Macintosh notebook in the studio now. We've got a notebook in here even running Linux. Operating systems other than Windows, are they just as easy to recover data from when there's a failure?
Well, it's specialised software. Again, our new version of Recover My Files, which is coming out towards the end of this year, will address the Macintosh file system. Now, Macs, while you have Windows computers that are formatted with FAT32 and NTFS operating systems, you get a file system called HPFS on Macintoshes. Yep. So it's just the way that the Mac computer understands the drive. So you need software that knows how to read that file system in order to try and recover the deleted files. But one of the things that Recover My Files does, one of the search capabilities that it has, is that it can ignore all the operating system information, and it can just search across the hard drive. And when you have a file, like a Word document, for example, that Word document has a file structure, which essentially means that at the start of the file is specific characters, so they all start a certain way, and basically they all end a certain way. So when you get right down to the lowest level of data recovery, what you can do is scan across a hard drive and then identify some data on a disk and recognize the header, the structure, and the footer, and then chop that piece of data off the drive and say, is this a Word file or a JPEG or a TIFF or whatever file type you're analyzing? And that really means that you can recover a specific file type of any type of file system.
I've got a really dumb question, only because I know my parents would fit this category. They have 3.5-inch floppies still. Remember those hideous things? Chances are it's not even going to read in a drive these days. Can Recover My Files actually look at a floppy out of curiosity?
Yes. It'll look at any drive connected to your computer. So as long as you connect something and it can see it as a drive letter, then you can examine it. And you have to be very careful with those things because, you know, they're very old now, and you might be able to read it once, but generally sending the read head across the drive, you know, you're probably going places that haven't been gone to for quite a long time, so they can fail at these, you know, these old, very old types of media quite easily.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, your website, getdata.com.au, I think it is. I'm looking at recovermyipod.com at the moment. You can download the trial versions there. Obviously, they work for a bit.
I like this feature of it, of being able to download the trial version to see if it's going to work before you pay for it. That's a great idea.
It's good, isn't it? I was just sort of thinking the same thing, because normally you come to sites like yours, Graham, when something terrible happens. So
yes.
What happens? You come to your site, you download. What would you recommend a user do straight after that?
Yeah, look, our main website is getdata.com. We, whilst we love selling software to Australians, it's really only a small percentage of our market. Most of our software is sold either in the US or in Europe, which is, I guess, is the wonders of doing business on the internet these days. You come to our software. Our main page is actually getdata.com. But you can go to one of the products, Recover My Files, Recover My Photos, Recover My iPod, etc. Download the software. Well, first of all, you have to assess your situation, and are you going to go through the process of taking that hard drive and connecting it to another computer, or are you going to take the slight risk of downloading, installing the software onto that particular drive? So just stay calm, evaluate the situation, download the software, install it, run it, and depending on what type of search you're doing and what type of recovery you're trying to get your data back from, whether it's a deletion or a format or some other drive problem, you'll run it, and then in the results screen you'll see a list of files and folders, and you can go through and you can preview, click on individual files and preview them. Now, I'll be the first to tell you, data recovery, it's no exact science. You don't know what's on the drive and what can be recovered until you look. You may have somehow managed to overwrite and destroy everything, in which case nothing will come back. So it's important that you use our software to preview, and once you can see the information you're looking for and confident that it's there and it can be recovered, then you can go back to our website, and you can purchase an activation key, which is sent to you straight away, and then all you do really is enter the activation key into the program, and that gives you the ability to save the files. And again, you have to save the files out to a different drive so that you're not writing the data back to that problem drive. Because of my background, as you mentioned, I came out of law enforcement in police. Our whole mentality was, if you're looking at someone's hard drive, you don't change the contents of it in any way. And we really carried that through in our data recovery software. So if it's not the solution for you and it doesn't work, then you haven't changed it in any way, and you're free to go and, you know, pursue other means.
Absolutely. I think that's a real key point, isn't it? And I think you mentioned it earlier, Graham, says here, looking across the panel, in respect to the fact that you don't want to be writing over the stuff you're trying to recover in an earlier sort of effort. So, Graham, it's been absolutely fantastic talking. I've learned a lot, and hopefully some of the listeners have also realised, oh, that's not too bad, because we all do, everyone. It's like a car crash, as Dr. Ron said. You do have that sinking feeling when you boot it up and it says net loader can't be found and all those sort of things.
Invalid boot sector. Yeah, that's as much as you get.
Yeah, so look, thank you very much for being on the show this evening and just telling us a little bit about the wares and sort of, in a lot of respects, just sort of how easy it is to do. Everything is easy when you know how, isn't it?
That's right. It's a bit of knowledge is a wonderful thing.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you once again. That's Graham Henley from GetData.com, GetData Proprietary Limited, an Australian company who are developing software which
and
actually...
selling to the world, which is a wonderful thing.
Which
I
is
love
good.
Those stories.
It's nice to see Australians actually exporting software and data rather than selling it all overseas and heading over there. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the top 100 most powerful brand names floating around the world at the moment. So that'll be very interesting. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Have you heard something on Tech Talk Radio worth talking about? Are you looking to share your technical dilemmas or opinions with like-minded Tech Talk Radio listeners? Well, now you can. Introducing the Tech Talk Radio web forum. Visit forum.techtalkradio.com.au and join our community. It's free and on a web browser near you. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Brands. What's in a brand? It's in Coca-Cola. Which do you think the largest brand name of the world is at the moment? We're talking globally here. Let me give you the tip. Australia doesn't rate a mention here. None of our companies are in the top 100 because we're such a sheltered, small, antipode convict place.
I'm going to go for the golden arches. I'm going to say McDonald's is the most recognised brand internationally.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyone else want to have a bit of a stab in the dark?
Well, I said Pepsi earlier.
Yeah, so. JD said Pepsi. I reckon Coca-Cola would be up there as well, fairly high.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'll go through the top 10. This is non-technological. This is brands, full stop. It's a survey which is done each year. But the number one brand worth $86.057 million, which is worth a lot.
Oh, is that
if
all?
I read that correct. Actually, that's $86 billion.
Billion,
sorry,
oh, that sounds better.
There's a string M next to it. $86 billion, which is growing in strength at a rate of 30% a year, is Google.
It is Google, Google up
it's
the
Google,
top.
Google, number one.
Wow.
Number two is GE, General Electric, worth $71 billion.
That's a bit of a surprise. Yeah.
Number three, Microsoft, worth 70, just slightly underneath GE, worth $70 billion. Then Coca-Cola, that used to be the world dominant brand, is then sitting underneath that at around about $58 billion.
At number four.
Yep, and then we're seeing the mobile carrier starting to come in. China Mobile, they've got a good market. They've got a lot of people there to sell mobile phones to.
Well, you have to look at their market exposure, that's right.
$57 billion, then $55 billion is IBM.
Where's Mickey Doodles?
Mickey Doodles is number eight.
Oh, boo.
But between IBM at number six and McDonald's at number eight is Macintosh, Apple, sitting in there at number seven. So Jobbies is worth $55 billion, $49 billion to McDonald's. Nokia, underneath that, $43
billion. Oh, I've heard of them.
Coming in at number 10, a cigarette company.
Ooh.
Would you believe, still in this day and age, a cigarette company is still managing to attract a little bit of market share there for a top brand name.
But it is interesting, the dominance of tech companies now in that top 10. Mm. That's quite impressive.
Mm.
Because 15 years ago, it would have just been food and...
That's right.
Sports and clothing.
Sports.
And
now,
what about Nike?
Nike, exactly.
Yes. Where's Nike on your list?
Yeah, I'll go through a few of the ones down the bottom there in just a sec, but I just want to talk about the top 10 because growth, brand value change is where it's all at the moment. Google had a 30% brand increase in respect to its value. The biggest brand increase, and by a long shot at 123%, one of those top 10s, which one do you think it was, boys?
He's looking at me. It's got to be Apple.
It was Apple.
Apple, was it? This is growth.
Apple with, their brand value has just gone through the roof. Apple, obviously, the release of the iPhone would have had a lot to do with that.
The release of Vista would have had a fair bit to do with it too,
absolutely,
I suspect.
Absolutely, Graham. Yes, you're right.
The best thing that's happened to Apple in years.
Although Microsoft still, I'm looking for it. Apple's 55 to Microsoft $70 billion. So he's catching. Mm. Bill, watch out. The other Mr. Jobs is on your tail there.
Not bad when they've only got, 10% of the market shares.
So. Absolutely. Mm. Well, no, but you're talking computers, though.
Mm.
We're talking iPhones and stuff like that. Apple have always done that exceptionally well. So, anyway, no wonder that's where they are. Just picking off a few others on the list here. Vodafone which is an international telecommunications company, coming in at number 11.
Yeah, they're big in the UK and Europe.
Vodafone are very big overseas, and they're not nearly as big here as they are in a lot of other places.
Another tech company, they've got 75% growth, which is also huge. Probably the second biggest growth after Apple in the current, the top range of them all. Then we've got a car company, Toyota. Then we're into
what a feeling.
Yeah, that's it. Toyota number 12, BMW number 17, companies like American Express at number 20. The reason why I'm skipping a few here is
have they got a negative growth recognition rate in American Express? They're on the way down.
Amex 7% growth, not too flash. The only one which has got negative in the top 10 is that cigarette company. That's got minus 5% growth. Shrinkage, call it.
Yes.
Other brands.
What's the cigarette company?
I think he's been avoiding saying it.
I wasn't going to say it.
Why not?
Well, I just don't think we need to be talking about those sort of things on the radio.
What sort of things?
Cigarettes. Oh. Anyway, there's a few other tech companies coming down the track. UPS, Tesco, Oracle, Intel. Intel's number 27.
27.
Then another car one, Porsche. Would you believe Porsche is at 28? Of the top brands.
Mm. Yeah, this is a recognised brand. I'd believe that.
Sitting down the bottom of page one is Mercedes-Benz, 36 in the top thing. They only had 1% change. Now, is this saying something about the world economy when you think about it? Luxury items, everyone's sort of falling flat a little bit.
Well, brand recognition, I mean, even...
We're talking about brand value.
Talking about brand value, you're talking about, I mean, that's not surprising that the higher value items are going to have that prestige, that value associated with their brand.
Mm.
If you're selling low value items to poor people, you're not going to have a big brand name associated with that.
That's right. So if Mercedes-Benz got into the economy cars market, then their brand exposure would probably increase.
They have, haven't they? I think there's a couple of those little zippy things or whatever. Yeah, those little zippy things that are around town.
They're not that cheap.
No. Anything with a Mercedes badge is not that cheap. The ambulances drive Mercedes, aren't they?
We do indeed.
There you go. Your Pepsi, number 39. So way down the runkers, but they used to be fairly dominant and thing. And Dell in at 41. And then we start hitting some of the fashion statements. Yeah. But we won't go there in the fashion. One interesting one is Starbucks coffee. Well, that's amazing. It's sitting at number 56 and is shrinking severely.
Oh,
they have such cruddy coffee. But that's a personal opinion, not of anyone else on the program. I must like my freshly ground coffee. They're shrinking at minus 25%. One of the other interesting brands, which is worth a mention, which even will blow our friend Mr. Jobs out of the water, technological, the BlackBerry. You know, that little funny little BlackBerry phones? Sitting at number 51 on the top 100 of most valuable brands, its growth rate is 390%.
And they're doing a bit of a Xerox, aren't they? People are using the term BlackBerry to describe any sort of PDA that allows you to SMS easily. So
It's a bit like Google, isn't it?
Yeah.
Google is a verb. BlackBerry is sort of heading in that sort of general direction too. So... The technology sector, including mobile operators, which accounted for 28 of the top 100 brands, outperformed all other categories in this year's brands ranking with a brand value growth of $187.5 billion, which is more than half of the top 100's total increase. So go technology.
Woohoo!
So anything surprise you there, boys?
Quite a bit of that was surprising, really.
Really?
It's hard to pick out what was the main surprising bit.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it is interesting that technology outstrips food, given that we sort of need food.
Well, it's a reversal from the past, isn't
it? Fast food is not far behind technology. The brand growth in mobile operators and technology, mobile operators was 35%, technology is 33%. Fast food, 27%.
Okay.
So it's not far, like the Golden Arches and those sort of establishments. We're all becoming slack and lazy and, just pop down the road for a quick, fry up, I guess, really, isn't it? Soft drinks was another big, interesting growth market too. I think everyone's into fizzy water these days, so. But, I thought that was
still more expensive than petrol, I think, here.
Oh, yes.
Only just.
If you want to know, we did a survey in the office the other day. We've discovered what the most expensive solution in a business world is, and it's printer ink.
Drink is very expensive. Yeah.
By the time you buy 3 mil of it, it costs you $45. Well, you're sort of thinking, wow. Anyway, so I think brand names are very important these days, and especially in the technological side of stuff, because things are actually going leaps and bounds, really.
Yep. Speaking of price of petrol, what about petrol companies, like the large international ones
I didn't see any at first glance.
Exxon and Shell.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I didn't see it. I've put the page down. We'll have to get back to it. We'll get back to the break or something like that. That'd be yeah, good. Let's talk, while we're talking about one of the large growth companies, Apple's Time Capsule is doing really well. We're talking about backing up and things that tonight. Do you use Time Capsule?
I don't have a computer new enough to use Time Capsule.
That's a problem. Maybe there's someone out there can give you one. Well, apparently one of the biggest selling points in the latest release of Mac's OS X 10.5 Leopard was the inclusion of Time Machine, a nifty application aimed at making the most onerous of tasks easy and fun. I don't know about fun, but you haven't used it yet. Have you heard about it?
I have. Apparently it works very well. Tip for those that haven't played with it yet is to connect your Time Capsule device to your computer via a cable first. The first backup is very long, and if you do it wirelessly, it'll take days. So do it by cable.
That's a good tip, really, isn't it?
And then incremental backups from then on.
So how does it work? Is it?
It's basically a hard drive connected to a wireless router. And so there's software, obviously, in there to allow
it. So you need, you get them by your portable hard drive or something like that? Is it?
No, it's complete. So when you buy the wireless router.
So it's one unit with drive in it.
The hard drive's in it, yes.
What size drive's in it?
Good question. 500 gig, I think. I'd have to have a quick look, but pretty big.
So it's a good option, really, by the sounds of it, for backing up. Does it do the operating system? Well, Mac's a great operating system because you just put the disk back in, don't you? The CD-ROM, if it falls over or something's not quite right, and you can boot off that.
That's right.
Well, the dodgy operating systems that we all have to use from time to time.
But the intention of the backup software built into to OS X Leopard is that it will keep incremental backups of everything you've done until you tell it not to. So it'll go back through versions. So if you've written your latest thesis on the brand names, it'll keep version 1, it'll keep a copy of version 2 and version 3. You don't have to worry about versioning it. You won't have to put a different number on it. It'll just keep a different copy of it at various intervals.
Fantastic. You Ubuntu Linux boys, does anything like this exist for that operating system?
No, not that I'm aware of.
I think Mac
of.
Do it so not on, well not on Ubuntu. When it comes to that. Compared to, like, Microsoft's backup, well, but yeah, anything Linux along those lines?
There is a Linux backup package. I've never been much of a fan of it. I just tend to tar everything up and save it on a USB drive. So,
oh, good. I'm glad I went there.
Yeah, on
tar is a way of archiving in the Linux world.
Sorry, yes, it's like a zip file. But you were a bit dismissive there of the backup process in Windows, and I think that's improved a lot since the early versions.
I hope
that
so.
Were huge amounts of trouble. It's still not a bulletproof backup system, but it works. It gets the job done these days. NT backup and with plug in a USB drive and do a file mode backup to it, and with the backup software that comes with Windows XP, it works quite well.
USB drives are cheap these days, aren't they?
That's exactly right. Yeah, it's really worth doing.
Feedback at techtalkradio.com.au. We'd like to hear your backup experience. We've heard Adam's before. Go back and have a listen to some of the view from the couches for some Mac experiences and some PC experiences. Mm. Let's talk, while we're talking Apple, Safari, web browser on the PC. Graham, we spoke about this recently. He calls it Foistware because it just appears and it's checked in the Apple
Apple update. Yeah.
Now, I've actually loaded it up at work. And can I tell you...
By mistake?
No, I deliberately did.
Okay.
Because, because I develop websites for a living amongst doing television and stuff like that, I thought it was really quite important to actually load up, because we're all PC-based. Yep. We have a couple of Macs in the office, but predominantly PC-based. And so to load up the Apple Safari onto an XP box, it worked. It went on really well.
Yeah.
Can I just say that I think it renders graphics the best out of the other browsers that I use.
It actually looks better, do you?
It looks so much better than Internet Explorer and Firefox combined.
That's such an Apple thing, isn't it? It just looks better.
It does. It's it renders text so much better. It looks really, really nice on the screen.
Mm.
And so much so that some of the guys in the office are going, oh, I think I'm going to use this as my default browser now. And having said that, just some feedback that this Foistware, where you actually, it just comes on the screen, it just loads up for you all by itself, is proving to be quite popular because there's been quite a shift in the marketplace to Apple Safari on the PC platform.
Apple have been pushing it a bit, but it's interesting that people are still interested in exploring browser options. Firefox is going leaps and bounds. It's absolutely huge. Yeah, people are looking for an alternative, and yeah, it's good that there's more competition out there.
In the new version of Ubuntu, they're shipping the new Firefox version 3, which is still in beta.
Yeah. But
that's
yeah.
Gutsy shipping it while it's in beta, isn't it?
It is. It's a very Linuxy thing to do.
Live on the edge. Keep everybody at the bleeding edge of the technology.
Absolutely. As I alluded to in the opening of the show, we've got the three new browsers releasing new software versions, major updates, IE8 coming out shortly. Let's hope, and goodness, they fix those bugs that are in IE7. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's pages and pages on the internet of workarounds if you develop for IE7 because it's such a problematic little monster. So
just don't use IE. One of the things they have been saying is that
there is a big push in Microsoft to make version 8 standards compliant.
That'd be lovely.
Well, no, but that's a big serious thing, and it will be interesting to see how much they achieve in that direction. But it's looking hopeful.
All right, Cuban, they're ending their computer ban. They've got a apparently you couldn't buy a computer in Cuba recently, but now people in Cuba can buy for the first time personal computers if they can afford it. One electrical shop in Havana has begun selling Chinese-made PCs, and so that for the first time they can now legally buy them to use them at home, but they can't go online yet.
Is the internet still banned, is it?
Oh, well, I don't know.
They probably haven't got an ISP yet.
No, yeah, well, that's... Yes. I don't know whether there's Cuban Telecom
or something.
They
could probably buy one of those from China as well, if they like.
Absolutely. We've got a mobile base network, a mobile phone network they could probably buy fairly cheaply at the moment,
They could.
Now, those Cuban computers cost almost $800.
Yep.
And it says here, this is in a country where the average wage is under $20 a month.
Wow. It's still pretty pricey then for a $20 a month.
It is. It's like hundreds of thousands of dollars for us.
In our society, we don't think about twice about getting a new PC. They're cheap. Laptops you can pick up for $600, $700 these days. Nothing if you really want them. Okay, and finally, before we go to the website, Gadget and Oddspot of the Week, something that was verging on the point of Oddspot, Gadget. I couldn't quite work this out, but computer keyboards can be dirtier than a toilet.
Yes.
You did some research on this, Dr. Ron. I saw an email from you.
I did, because people don't wash their hands and people are disgusting and they
eat their lunch over their keyboards.
And like we were saying before about, you know, you're going to do a service call on a VCR and you open it up and there's crusty bits of Vegemite sandwich inside the VCR. And it's the same with computers. If a mouse stops working and you open it up to clean it, it's full of gunk and muck and
they
dust.
They work so much better after that, though.
These days, you very rarely do open a keyboard. If it stops working, you throw it out and plug a new one in.
Well, that's Dr. Ron's testament to and his laptop over there.
Yeah, but...
Jeff Dudley's just sent us an email just concurring with my thoughts on Safari.
Oh, yeah.
In respect that it's twice as fast and renders so much better. So
There you go.
We've gone back to Safari, the thing to watch will actually be the other third-party providers, because Apple's WebKit is the kernel of Safari's rendering engine, a bit like the Gecko engine behind Firefox. So Oprah and a number of other browser providers...
Oprah? She's a television presenter,
isn't
she?
Yeah. But the other browser providers that use WebKit in the Mac platform may well use this as a bit of a hook to get into the Windows area.
Interesting. All right, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. We better go because we've got the Oddspot gadget and website of the week coming up just after this.
You're listening.
Dr. Ron?
Here I am listening.
Residual powers. And I've got some residual powers.
You can't turn off CDMA.
In terms of the volume,
motorists have to give fingerprints. Now, this
may have digressed.
Talk radio.
Bill Burgess also claimed the country would remain behind.
We used to think 600 kilometers.
Don't open things that are as good as you're not expecting, even if they do look good.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Tech Talk Radio wants your feedback. Call the Tech Talk Radio feedback line or visit our website and tell us your thoughts on the show. Tell us your likes and dislikes, your technical dilemmas and program suggestions. Call 1-300-664-882 and leave a voice message. That's 1-300-664-882 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au, and click on the feedback link.
In this house, we obey the laws of thermodynamics!
Cool!
Tech Talk Radio's Gadget of the Week.
This week's gadget is Belkin's HDMI Interface 3-to-1 Video Switch. What is a Belkin HDMI Interface 3-to-1 Video Switch, I hear you ask? This is essentially an HDMI. Well, maybe I didn't hear anyone ask that.
No, the silence is deafening in
the
studio.
This is essentially an HDMI switch box. It's for people with a limited number of HDMI inputs on their television. But you might
What's
have
an HDMI input?
An HDMI input is a high-definition multimedia interface input. It's on the new televisions, Graham, and it's a purely digital input from digital devices.
So this connects your HD set-top box or your Blu-ray player to
your PlayStation 3.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, or your satellite receiver, anything with a digital output. So it's carrying video and audio.
It's like your optical cable.
Up the one cable.
So if you've got more of these devices than you've got HDMI inputs on your plasma.
That's what this gadget's designed for.
Oh, I like it.
You like it. So what you can do is hop up out of your chair and press a button to switch the input, or even better, you can pick up a remote control.
It's got a remote control.
It has got a remote control, so you can switch inputs from your couch.
That's what we need.
Oh, I need one of those.
Connects up to 3 high-def video sources into 1 HDMI port for your TV. It supports 480p, 720, and 1080p resolutions.
Do you know what you're talking about?
Absolutely no idea whatsoever. Works with HDCP compliant devices. Do you know what that is, Andrew? HDCP?
Is it like a DHCP server?
Copy protection thing. It allows you to display it without being able to copy it.
So if you're running that through the device, it'll work. You've got your remote control, and if you want more information, go to www.belkin.com.au.
Here it is, everybody, the world's greatest website.
Tech Talk Radio website of the week.
Andrew, don't forget the milk.
Why?
On the way home. Do you have phone calls? Don't forget the milk. Now, you can send that person who sends you those texts to an website. Rememberthemilk.com.
Oh, dear.
It's an online task management site. It's got a good intuitive interface, which makes managing tasks fun.
Does it?
This will be fun.
Does it get the milk for you? That's what I want to know.
Does it remind you of more than just milk, though? Because we get that delivered. I've solved that problem.
Oh, okay. Well, this mightn't be for you, JD. No, it can remind you of anything. You can set due dates for any task.
Does it text you? How does it work?
It can text you. It can send you an email. It can send you a message through AIM, Google Talk, ICQ, Skype, MSN, and
Yahoo. How much does it cost?
It's absolutely 100% free of charge.
Oh, get out of here.
No,
there's got to be a catch.
No, there's no catch. It's a web-based, Web 2.0 type service. It can even integrate task lists with your iPhone or your iPod Touch or your BlackBerry. www.rememberthemilk.com.
There is a fine line between genius and madness.
Shoot. Missed it by that much.
I know nothing.
Houston, we have a problem.
The Odd Spot on Tech Talk Radio.
A $300,000 wristwatch is pure luxury. But a $300,000 wristwatch that doesn't tell the time and that sells out is pure genius.
This is why I always dread this segment.
Took the words out of my mouth.
A watch that doesn't tell time.
Swiss watchmaker Romain Jerome just launched the day and night watch. The watch won't tell you what time it is, but it does tell you whether it's day or night. Helpful, I guess.
I can work that out by looking outside.
If you're a billionaire who can't afford Windows.
The company in Antarctica might be useful.
The company's website boasts, with no display for the hours, minutes or seconds, the day and night offers a new way of measuring time, splitting the universe into two fundamentally opposing sections, day versus night.
Should we just
night.
Run the closing music now?
the company's chief executive, Ivan Arpa, cited statistical studies to explain how the watch better reflects the time philosophy.
And did he explain when he lost touch with reality?
Today's wealthy. He said anyone can buy a watch that tells the time, only a truly discerning customer can buy one that doesn't.
Next week on Tech Talk Radio, Jason Sterling will be in to continue our business-to-business discussion. Jason's been in before, talking about IVR systems and the likes. And also we're going to have a chat to Harvey Sanchez from Microsoft this week about what the cloud is. You know, Microsoft into the weather now? Well, we'll explain all that next week.
No, it's the cloud, the online cloud.
That's the one.
That's where they're
not the clouds from Windows 95.
No, they blew
new
away.
Clouds.
No, this is new clouds that new store clouds. All your personal data
You log
online.
In and it's all new. Microsoft having a go at Google. Anyway, oh, by the way, Developer Week's coming up for Microsoft very shortly. I've registered. I'll be going. I'll take the Tech Talk Radio microphone with me. You never know who you might with.
Yes.
Anyway, we've got to go now. It's been lovely. Till next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio, brought to you each and every week by a group of dedicated professionals from within the media, broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron Panlis, Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins, expert opinion Adam Turner, and our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Post-production facilities courtesy of Evolving Communications. Podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night at 8 p.m. from the studios of 3WBC. The crew wish to thank all the stations that take the show, including 3WBC and 3XX in Melbourne, Cairns FM, Switch 1197 in Brisbane, 95.3 Huon FM in Tasmania, Queer FM in WA, and Stop and Go Radio in the United States. For sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9018 9043 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.